When I was trying to decide exactly what to talk about this morning, there's all kinds of things. There's a really good book you can go to pick out subjects like this. It's called The Bible. And there's lots of things in the Bible. My wife suggested that I have two of them prepared. And then we take a vote as to which one we would have a lesson on. She said, what you really ought to do is you get one on hell and one on money, and then take a vote and see what they want to select it. But I'm going to let you off the hook. I only prepared one lesson. And it wasn't the one on hell. It was the one on money. So I guess in a way I'm about the only one in the church who would do this, simply for two reasons. Dan, to my knowledge, has never preached a topical sermon or series on money or giving. And it would be a little bit embarrassing to think, because the largest expenditure of a church is the keeping of the pastor. And, you know, he might think he's doing it for the money or something. David would not, because he knows who gives what. And he's the treasurer, and he knows who writes the checks. I don't have a clue. I mean, I don't have a dog in the hunt, as they say, because, you know, if you double my salary, it still equals zero. And I don't know who gives what. So as I talk about money, I would just like to look at what comes from Scripture and to give some ideas in it. You know, I must remind you that in my formal education, I have 2 degrees in economics. But I have also found that in studying the Bible through the years and listening to people who know what they're talking about and a whole lot smarter than I am, like Larry Burkett and Ron Blue and what's the guy with the glasses and the little beard? Dave Ramsey, that's it. There's a lot more that the Bible has to say about economics, as well as micro, as well as macro, than what I ever learned in any of those classes in undergraduate or graduate school, either one. But as we skip a stone across the surface of the topic, it's good to remember, too, that there's a lot more to talk about from a lot of different angles, because the Bible talks about money as much as it does about any other subject. So let's get it off my chest anyway to start with. What is the number one rule of economics? It is unlimited wants and limited means. Have you ever heard that taught before? Economics is all about unlimited wants and limited means. Every one of us wants a bunch of stuff. By human nature, we just want to compile that somehow. If you could make more money than you're making now, you probably would buy more stuff with it. It's just human nature. You want more than you can get, and the limited means comes in because you only can get a certain amount either from a paycheck or from a business that you're working in yourself. That was the first thing that was taught me when I walked into my very first economics class back at the University of Kentucky, and it hasn't changed a bit. It's still the same, and it always will be the same. But I'm going to tell you how you can make money, if that's what you want, is to make money. It's one of those things that's very simple, but it's difficult to carry out. I can remember when we first got in the cattle business that one of the veterinarians, Dr. Darty from Hopkinsville, said, I'll tell you the secret of the cattle business. And I can tell it to you in one word. I said, okay, I'm all ears. I want to know. He said, it's management. I said, terrific. How's that help me a bit? These one-word answers are simple, and they're true, but they're difficult to carry out. Well, the same thing that I'm going to tell you today is simple, but it's difficult to carry out. You can make money, more money, by 2 different methods. One is excellence, and one is volume. If you do something, even something unimportant like playing baseball, if you do something so excellently that you can get a lot of people to pay you to do it, if you are so good at it, then you can make a bunch of money by just doing that one thing. Not very many people can do that. And I say unimportant like baseball, I could just as easily include any number of other unimportant things, but that's one of them. Let's set that aside. Excellence is a good idea. Proverbs talks about excellence, and those who do excellent work will stand before kings. They will not stand before mean men. And that's good. That's proper. The way most people make money, though, is by volume. That was the second choice. Farmers do that all the time. If you grow one stalk of corn, and it is the best stalk of corn that the world has ever seen, you do it excellently, you're not ever going to have enough to make a living out of, because even the very best stalk of corn will not give you enough volume to pay your bills. If you grow 1 acre of corn in today's times, 1 acre of corn at the record yield is never ever going to make enough money to pay your bills. Right? Selling crop insurance. If you had one policy and you did the best in following up on it, Tanya, of anybody who's ever done in crop insurance, it's not enough volume. Okay? Volume. You get a small gain on something that you do, you multiply it times the volume, and you add time to it. So you've got a little bit of money times a volume, hopefully will be increasing, add time to it, and you'll have money or wealth or whatever kinds of things you want. Sounds real simple, but it's difficult to do. But the potential is still there, and I'll give you an example. I read a book years ago called The Alpha Strategy, and this is what they had to say, that a little bit of money over a long period of time equals a whole lot of money. Larry Burkett taught it. The Bible teaches it. Ron Blue taught it. Dave Ramsey teaches it. But to just put it in perspective, you remember Manhattan Island when it was first sold to the white men from the Indians? They spent, what, $22, if I remember right, trinkets and stuff they gave to the Indians and bought Manhattan Island. This was back in the early 1600s. Al Homiak could tell you the exact date. Or could you? Okay, early 1600s. $22. If you increase that $22 in its purchasing power by only 10% per year, 10%. That's like taking a dollar and next year you get $1.10, or the $22, you'd have $27 and some odd cents. You do that every year for the last 400 years, and how much money would you have? Trevor, do you have any idea? You'd have a whole lot more than that. If you increase it by 10% each year, you would have more wealth than all the world has ever seen. That's how big it would be. 10% per year for 400 years. So if you increase your purchasing power, regardless of whether it's in terms of dollars or bushels or whatever it may be, acres or houses, you can, over enough period of time, you can accumulate more wealth than the world has ever known. That's the magic of compound interest, if you want to call it that way, or the purchasing power. Problem is that none of us live 400 years, Trevor. So we have a finite amount of time in which to invest ourselves. But the principle is still the same. Here's the principle. If you limit yourself, if you discipline yourself to set aside something more than you spend, and you set that aside so that it accumulates a little bit over time, you'll have a whole lot of money. Now, with that having been said, that's not the purpose of my talk this morning, and the Bible never talks about how to get rich. I'm just giving you a clue, a little bit of an insight there as to how things work. The Bible talks more about what you do with it when you get it, right? What do you do with the money when you get it? It talks a lot about tithing. Half of those scriptures that I've looked up anyway are in the Old Testament, and half of them are in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, it comes, did you know tithing? People say, oh, that's kind of legalistic. It's bound to be based in the law somewhere. Did you know tithing was mentioned in when Abraham gave tithes to Melchizedek? Was, they say, I wasn't there, they say it was 430 years before the law was ever given. Therefore, the idea of tithing came from something prior to the law. So it's not legalistic. It is something that somehow God imparts to His people, that you're supposed to be giving a certain amount back to God's people, to God's work. That's what tithing is all about. Somehow recognizing, whether it's 10% or more than that or whatever it is, somehow recognizing that whatever we have, no matter how big a pile it is, it doesn't belong to us anyway. Even the The 90% that's left over after you give your tithe doesn't belong to us. God owns everything there is. Cattle on 1,000 hills and the bank accounts in 1,000 banks and just hope that his accounting is a whole lot better than they did in the country that confiscated all the money. What was a little island country that confiscated 90% of some of their depositors' money? Remember that? Just Cyprus. Yeah. Cyprus got in trouble and they said, oh, we know, we'll just take away people's money. And that's what they did. God doesn't do that, by the way. He says the treasures are laid up in heaven for you. If you go to 1 Peter, moth and rust do not corrupt. Thieves don't break in and steal. It's not going to rust. It's not going to go away. It's laid up for you there. Okay? If you wanted to look up some of those scriptures that I'm talking about, and I'm not going to go down through them because you get the idea. You know what a tithe is. You know what giving is. Genesis 14 is when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. Leviticus 27:30 is when tithes were supposed to be given over to the Lord's work. Here's one that I thought was kind of interesting. Numbers 18:26, and that is the priests themselves were to tithe of the tithe that they got from the rest of the people. So full-time Christian ministers, they're tithing as well. At least that's what the Scripture has said we're supposed to do. Deuteronomy points out the fact, 14:22, if you want to write that one down, it points out that the tithe is supposed to be from our increase. So if someone thinks, in farmer terms, like I do, you know, I plant a bushel of corn and I make 150 bushels of corn, does that mean that I'm supposed to tithe the whole 150? Well, if you do, you'll go broke because there's a lot of expenses that are built into that. It's from the increase, not the total return, gross versus net. We'll get into that another time if you want to talk about that. Malachi 3:7-12 is a long passage about building up treasures and adding to the storehouse. And then you switch over to the New Testament. If you like red letters better than the black letters, we can go to that one. Matthew chapter 23:23, where Jesus chides. In fact, he more than chides the Pharisees. He condemns the Pharisees for concentrating on tithing only the physical stuff, the mint and the cumin, whatever that is, and the little things, but forgetting to tithe the things, the bigger things that they should have been doing. Luke chapter 11:42 is the same. 18:12 in Luke is talking about the guy who thought he was special because he tithed. He was a self-righteous guy, and he says, look at me, I'm really special. And it gets down to the attitude, which is we're going to talk about here in a minute. 2 Corinthians 9:7 says, whatever percentage it is, whatever you choose to give to the Lord, do it cheerfully. Don't do it because you think you have to. Do it cheerfully. God loves a cheerful giver. Hebrews 7:8, it talks about tithing that happens here on earth as well as tithing that takes place in heaven. Did you ever hear about that, tithing in heaven? How in the world could that be? But look it up, Hebrews chapter 7, verse 8. And then, quoting the Lord in Acts chapter 20, verse 35, it says, it is more blessed to what? To give than to receive. Now, how could that be? I was taught, especially back when Don Griffey was looking at the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, that the idea of being blessed is also can be translated happy. So how can you be happier when you're giving than when you're receiving? I mean, every kid I know doesn't go to the Christmas tree to put presents under it. He goes to the Christmas tree to get presents from it, right? But yet somehow in the scheme of things, God has made every one of us so that there is a happiness that's associated with giving things away. So you got two sides. You got Madam Blueberry over here. Remember what Madam Blueberry is about? Anybody watch the VeggieTales? I had the privilege of watching one of the VeggieTales the other night, and it's all about Madam Blueberry. She collects stuff in a big house. In fact, the representatives of the Stuff Mart come to visit her, and she can buy the stuff and stick it in the house. Collecting stuff is one of the things that we would be told by the world, which is a really good thing to do. The other side of that is giving some of it away. Instead of collecting it all for ourselves, to give some of it away. This guy here, Dave Ramsey, had two things that I'd like to share with you from one of the chapters in this book that he had. The book is called Financial Peace Revisited. The short one is this, and I'll give you the short version. He says, I have met very, very few people who are healthy and wealthy and happy who don't consistently give some of their money away. That should tell you right there that there's something involved in the human makeup made by God that means that we are happier, we're more fulfilled when we give some away. Now, I know you guys are generous. You know, I don't know who gives what, but I see the bank statements when they come in quarterly when Dave puts them together. And for a church small like this, there are some very generous people here who have made it their business to see that our bank account stays above zero. But I will say this, too, that no matter where you go, and if this message goes all the way around the world, which it won't, I don't think, but if it did, I would say this to anyone who's listening. If you are going to a church that you don't feel comfortable in giving some to, you need to find a church where you are comfortable in giving something to. And give it there. If you're not happy with the church you're going to, if you can't give financially, find one you can. About a week ago, I got a story on Fox News. I don't know if you guys are readers of Fox News or not, but there's a mega church somewhere on the East Coast, I believe it was, who sent letters like this to some of their members or some of the people who attend. And basically what it said was, if you're not going to take part, go somewhere else. Can you imagine a church sending that out? But somehow they kept up with the ones who had given and the ones who had volunteered and the ones who had participated. And they said, you know, we're doing three services now. We don't have room. If you don't want to participate here, go somewhere else. Well, now, I can't say that that's a biblical attitude to have. But I think the idea is a good one. You need to be able to support the church you attend. I assume you do. And I'm glad you do. Here's the other thing that Dave Ramsey had. And I think I just went to the wrong place. Yeah. Oh, here we go. I found it. This is a relatively short thing, and it's like a riddle. And you identify what it is. And I'll tell you what it is at the end, but here's the description that he had of it. The author is unknown. And this has more to do with the accumulation of money than it does of the spending of money, but it could be either one. You could apply it to impulse buying versus and disciplined budgeting as well as any other part of financial endeavors. Here's what it says. I am your constant companion. I am your greatest helper or your heaviest burden. I will push you onward or drag you down to failure. I am at your command. Half of the tasks that you do, you might just as well turn over to me, and I will do them quickly and correctly. I am easily managed. You must merely be firm with me to show me exactly how you want something done. After a few lessons, I will do it automatically. I am the servant of all great people and, alas, of all failures as well. Those who are great, I have made great. And those who are failures, I have made failures. I'm not a machine, but I work with all the precision of a machine plus the intelligence of a person. Now you may run me for profit or you may run me for ruin. It makes no difference to me. Take me, train me, be firm with me, and I will lay the world at your feet. Be easy with me and I will destroy you. Who am I? I'm called Habit. A habit. You think about that and all of the different things that he mentioned in there. Habit. You can make habits for good or you can make habits for ill. And I think the point that he's making in that chapter and the point I would get to you is that you can bring yourself into subjection to your own will so that you have good habits as well as bad habits. We can actually avoid the things that cost us financial as well as spiritual pain, and we can inculcate those things which cause discipline and return. So, I never like to go more than about 20 minutes. There's a lot to be said, but let's bring this thing in for a landing. you know, the Bible is not so much, as the way I read it anyway, on exact amounts that giving should be done or exact amounts of money that can be earned. It can be, you know, the sky's the limit on either one of them. What the Bible does talk about is the attitude with which we do either one of them. There's all kinds of nasty ways of making money. I don't know if you guys read the article not long ago about the parking lot attendants at the Smithsonian Institute. They were given the task of taking in the money as people came in and parked. And somewhere over a one-year period of time, the owner of the parking lot noticed that his profits were going down quite a bit. And so he put up security cameras to see what the parking lot attendants were doing. And there was a cadre of both attendants and supervisors who had agreed that a certain percentage of those would be pocketed and shared with each other rather than being turned over to the parking lot attendant owner. Over a period of 1 year, they had pocketed over $1 million from dishonest, it's called stealing. And at first, as they corralled the one gal who supposedly, they said, all right, during the month of so-and-so, you took in this much money. That means we multiply it by 12s, and you have taken $1.2 million. And she says, no, that's not right. I didn't steal anything during the month of Ramadan. So she had set aside herself a type of righteousness where when she didn't steal during Ramadan, she was doing Allah a favor. But the rest of the time, she could steal. That's not the kind of attitude with which we should earn or give. There's all other kinds of pages up here that I could share with you. You know how those things work. There's dishonest ways of making a living, and there's honest ways of making a living. Here's the point, and this is from Crown Financial Ministry. It said, remember that God is more concerned about the attitude of your heart in giving than the percentage of the amount given. Nevertheless, the minimum he asks of his people to give is a tithe. That's Crown Financial Ministries. Something to think about. There's a lot more we could talk about, but let's call it done. Let's close with a hymn. And I didn't tell you guys we were going to do a hymn, but that's just the way I work. Kind of spur of the moment. Shoot from the hip. And I'll let you pick out a good one. Do you know a good one? 404, okay? Oh, the solid rock. That is a good one. You'll see some scurrying around as the instruments come back out of their cases. Sorry about that, guys. Big surprise to everybody. That's what keeps things interesting. Variety is the spice of life, right? Okay, why don't you all stand with me, and we'll sing all four verses of 404. Thank you. Good reminder. Is there anything else that needs to be said this morning before we dismiss? Okay, I'll take that as a no. Al Homiak, you mind dismissing us in prayer, please?